So let's learn. We have an absolutely new section now. So this is going to be David's children. We've looked at David HaMelech's life. We looked at some of the challenges he had externally and internally. Now we move into a whole new section. It's hard to really create artificial guidelines to group Tanakh because Tanakh is so interwoven that it's very hard to sort of, you know, put into silos. But nonetheless, just for the sake of being able to learn it in themes, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on Perek Yud Gimel to Perek Yud Tes / Chof, we'll see, about David HaMelech's children. In fact, we may even be able to name the section David and Avshalom, maybe as a bigger section, because it really relates all to him more specifically, but we'll see that it's more complex than meets the eye. So here we're going to address this. Now, I want to just, as a forward of this to this section, for those who've had a chance to learn this before, you know to brace yourselves, but for those who've not learned this before, just to give you a sense of the complication of this very, very sensitive area in Tanakh. So the Rambam tells us in Hilchos Tefillah, just one specific example of how this works. The Rambam is describing that in general, when they would read Tanakh or any part of the Torah, they would translate it as well. So it means to say that when you'd have the person reading it in Hebrew, there would be somebody reading it in Aramaic. Aramaic was the lingua franca of the entire area, of the region. And that's why it is that the Gemara is written in Aramaic. So a lot of the Gemara is written in Aramaic. So there will be halachas about what you read and translate. The Rambam tells us in the halachas of Tefillah the following. Just take a quick look at source 1. He says, V'loi kol mikrois metargaminon betzibor. Not all parts of the Bible, not all parts of Tanakh do we translate publicly. And he gives examples. Ma'aseh Ruvain, the story that happens with Ruvain. Birkas Kohanim, the blessings of the priests. Umaaseh Egel, that's fascinating, right? The episode of the Egel in Kisisa. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron ad vayar Moshe es Ha'am, that's all section. Od Pasuk Echad. Vayigov Hashem es Ha'am, kulam nikroim v'loim metargaminon. That we read it in Hebrew, but we do not read the Aramaic translation, so we don't want to publicize it. Uve Maase Amnon b'makom sheneemar Amnon ben David nikra v'loy mitargem. And this parak, this chapter, is not translated either. So, meaning, if you're thinking about the equivalence over here, this is obviously a very sensitive, very difficult section in Tanakh to read, which is why it's not for the Hamon Am, when we're doing a public rendition of the Torah reading or the Tanakh reading, it is not translated because it's difficult. Nonetheless, it still is learned, which is what we're doing. So we're learning it for the sake of trying to understand the underpinnings, the messages that are here. But just to walk into the sensitivity that this is a very difficult section on Tanakh. We have to question ourselves, why is it included? What is it here to teach us? What aspects can we learn from it, either about human nature or about perhaps the bigger picture of David HaMelech's life? So that's without much further ado. So we're told the following. So again, what we're going to do is we're going to look in sections rather than pasuk by pasuk. Let's just sort of look at a section, try to absorb some of the ideas, question the main issues, then move on to the next section. The first section that naturally formulates itself is the first paragraph, which is Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Aleph to Hey. So let's sort of set the scene over here. Here it is. Vayhi acharei chein. It is after this. This means the David and Bathsheba incident. So automatically we are in the shadow. Automatically, before we go even further, we know that this incident is in the shadow. And the Mefarshim, we're going to struggle to understand why does Tanakh need to tell us that it's in the shadow. And Ul Avshalom ben David achos yafeh ushmo Tamar. And Avshalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister, and her name was Tamar. Vaye ehaveho Amnon ben David. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. We have to question a lot of things here. First of all, the relationships that's a very strange way of describing relationships. Right? Meaning to say, it could just go straight from Tamar to Amnon. Avshalom doesn't need to be an apparent part of this equation. The word vayeh ahaveh, we have to question what that really means. What does his love mean? Vayetzer la'amnon la'hischalois, and he became so agitated to the point of sickness. Ba'avur Tamar achosai, because of Tamar, his sister, ki besulahi, she was yet unmarried. Vayipolei be'enov Amnon la'asois la'mu'uman. And there was no way to get near her, to do anything, to be around her. Ulanon Rea, and he had a friend, Ushmo Yonadav ben Shimo Achi David. So he was a friend, he was the son of Shimo, the brother of David. And by the way, Yonadav is a name which appears elsewhere in Tanakh, so it's a commonly used name. Ish Chacham Mo'od, he was a very wise person. Vayomer Lo, Madua Atokacha Dal ben Amelech Baboker, Baboker, Lo Tagidli, why are you so melancholy Please tell me. Vayomer lo Amnon. Es Tamar achos Avshalom achi ani ohev. I love the sister of Avshalom, my brother. Vayomer lo Yehonadav. And Yehonadav says to him, Shechava mishkavcha v'yischal. Become sick, lay yourself in your bed, and uvo avicha lirasecha, and your father will come to visit you. Vamarta elov, tovo no samar achosi, v'savreni lechem, v'osa leinai, es habir yo. And so let her come and feed me, let her make the meal for me, laman asher ere, so I should see, v'ochalti mi yado, and I should eat from her hand. So he's going to sort of get David HaMelech to facilitate a meeting. So that's the first section. Obviously, you know, sort of disaster pending. So a few things just to think about over here is, first of all, who is he? Who's Avshalom? Who's Tamar? Who are these people? We don't know. We don't have any context, but we do. That's why we learn Shmuel Beis Perek Gimel first, right? Because in Shmuel Beis Perek Gimel, we actually learn the relationships. It's important to know who is who in relationship to whom. What's the constellation of siblings here? Because otherwise we have no context. So let's get the family tree set up quickly. David HaMelech is married to a number of wives. At the beginning it was two, it was Abigail, and I think, who was the second one? Michal, right. And then there was a few later as he assumed kingship in the south. So here we go. Here's as he assumes kingship in the south. Shmuel Beis Perek Gimel Posuk Beis Tuhei. Vayivaldu leDavid Banim beChevron. These are the children he had in Chevron. Vayi Bechora, who's his firstborn? Amon. So the first thing we should know is, it's not just random, this is his firstborn. What does firstborn mean in those days? This means heir. Heir, right, with an H. So he is the crown prince. This now gives us perspective. So when David HaMelech is relating to Amnon, he's relating to him as his treasured, cherished firstborn. First point to realize why David's coming to see him. The tone of David HaMelech's conversation. Let's understand that. Vayhi b'chora Amnon v'ala Achinoam ha-Yisraelis to Achinoam. Umishneu, and his second, Kilav, Avigail, Eshes, and Aval HaKarmali. Vashlishi, and the third is Avshalom ben Maacha, Bas Talmai, Melech Geshur. So then we have Avshalom. Avshalom is really third in line, essentially. Okay, so Avshalom is relationship to Amnon is half brother. Okay, so now not mentioned in this because it's mentioning heirs at this point, to the kingship. So not mentioned in this, of course, is Avshalom's sister, who is Tamar, who we find out about now in Perek Yud Gimel, in Shmuel Beis. Okay, so that's the setting. Notice something interesting about his matrilineal descent as well. Interesting, right? Although we have met Achinoam and we've met Avigail, we know those characters, we haven't met Maacha so much. Maacha is the mother of Avshalom and therefore, by extension, Tamar, and we don't know so much about her. We do know in these psukim that she is Bas Talmai Melech Geshur. That sounds like a political marriage, right? It sounds like we can assume that this must be, she probably has some sort of conversion process, but it sounds like she was originally from outside of the fold. Okay, just for facts to put into the equation. So Avshalom is the younger half-brother, he is not the heir, and there's Tamar in the picture. Okay, so that's the constellation before we start our investigation. Okay, so one of the big questions that all the Mepharshim have is, yeah, clearly, Amnon is besotted with this Tamar. He is head over heels with her, whether it means real love or it means lust or whatever else we're going to put into that. But nonetheless, there's one big problem over here, and that is that how do you deal with the fact that there is no possibility for this relationship to ever work? Meaning, he is a half-brother to her. There's no way, not in his greatest or greatest fantasies or delusions, is he ever going to ever be able to marry her. She's a sister. His half-sister counts in the same way, right? He can't marry her. So what's going on over here? What's happening in his mind? Is he really so completely consumed by this that he's ignoring that? Or is how do we even start the equation? Where's this all beginning? Where did this inkling of a thought ever enter his head, or perhaps his emotions, more to be more specific? If there was no sense of possibility. And by the way, this is important to think about because remember, like in the cognitive world, right, in the world of cognitive therapy, what we can't change is necessarily our emotions, but we can change the framework, the cerebral framework or the lens through which we see things, which we'll be able to change our emotions. So the example even Ezra gives in Parsha, in the Aseret Dibros, is the Torah tells us, don't envy. Well, That's very hard because that's an emotion. So how in the world am I supposed to, what's the leverage I have on my emotions? I can't really crank that shaft so easily. I can act. I can, you know, talk. I cannot talk. I cannot act. But how can I have emotions or not have emotions? So Ibn Ezra says, very simple process. Ibn Ezra says, imagine that you have a fellow who lives in the far reaches of the kingdom, beyond where they make street signs anymore. You know that kind of area? No tarred roads, no lighting, not even street signs, right? Not even historical area. And he's one day picking potatoes in his backyard, and along the dust road drives a white stretch limousine. And seven windows down, the window rolls down, and there the princess, the heir of the entire kingdom, looks out, and her hair blows in the wind with her pearls catching the sunlight. And he looks at her. Is there anything that's going to go through his mind now? Now, I know we've all watched Aladdin. But let's be honest. Is there anything going through his mind that he ever thinks that maybe in the wildest of his dreams he's going to marry her? And the answer is no. Because his station in society, picking potatoes in his backyard, doesn't even give him the, we'll call it, mental infrastructure to be able to even think about that. So Ibn Ezra says, if the Torah tells you that what you get is what you get, and what your neighbor gets is not going to affect or impact you in any way whatsoever, if that realization is so concrete to you, then you look at somebody or something or some other relationship, and it's not even within your realm of possibility, so you don't think about it with the thoughts of envy. That's the way it's supposed to work. Meaning, how do we change emotions? We change our mindset. That's the cognitive window. And cognitive behavioral therapy caught up a few hundred years afterwards. Right? So that's where we're at. So that's the question with Amnon. What's going through his mind here? Is he just, is there something crooked in his mindset? Is he so overcome? Or is there a possibility? So the Mepharshim debate this. And similarly, it's almost as if, by the way, Nahavdil, because this is much worse than everything we've seen up to now. But it seems to be that there's a similar kind of line of division between the Mepharshim, with our poles being on the one hand the Malbim and the other end the Abarbanel. We can plot all the other Mepharshim in line with those two poles. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Here's what the Malbim suggests. We're looking at this, like what's happening at the beginning over here. Malbim says, let's take a look. This is source 3. Malbim tells us, Omnam, b'chol ha-parsha koro achosi. In the entire parsha, she is called his sister. Uvoze onu muchrachim el kabalos chachomenu zichronim v'ocha. The Malbim defaults to Chazal's interpretation, like he does by David and Bathsheba. Shemacha ein tamar ha-yisla yafas to'ar. She was a yafas to'ar. What does that mean? She was pretty, but yes, but that's actually a halachic designation as well. She was an Eishes Yafas Torah. So let's reverse to one of the strangest parashas in the Torah, which is the beginning of parashas Kisaitse. Kisaitse la milchama olvecho, bora isa vashivyo, Eishes Yafas Torah. Right, so the soldier's on the road. He's been on the road. He's been away from his home for months on end. Only seen grime and killing and murder and lack of food, and suddenly they come to a village, and there's the welcome committee, and there's a beautiful young lady, right? What happens in this situation? So the Torah, the way that it's understood by the Mepharshim, is Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzirah, is that if the Torah says no relationships in this context, certainly in the way that it's working, and if you read any war literature, we know it's not going to be potentially successful. So the Torah gives a way, a sort of channel for this, for wartime. What is that? Is that there can be a marriage for a we'll call it a wartime shidduch, but there are certain parameters. There are certain parameters, and that need to be laid in place. And she has to be separate, and she mourns for her parents, and then right, and she cuts her nails, and hey, there's a whole business. At the beginning of Parshas Kisaitse. So says the Malbim, but quoting Chazal, she, Ma'acha, mother of Tamar, was an Eishes Yafas Torah, which means that how did he meet her? That also explains the matrilineal lineage. It wasn't a political marriage so much as it was a battle marriage that occurred. God carries on the Malbim. David And therefore, as the Torah actually allows, that means to say Tamar was the product of David HaMelech's relationship with her in war, right? Which means to say that ultimately she was actually born non-Jewish, right? So Tamar was actually born non-Jewish. Umidin Torah hi muteres lamnon ki bincha b'neich habo min ha'akum eino kore b'neich. That means to say that a child born in a state of not Jewishness, even though they convert afterwards, there's not a, we'll call the natural halachic relationship between the different family members. Right? So that means that they are not related to one another. So therefore, technically speaking, Amnon and Tamar are not really half sisters and half brothers in that sense, because this came from this very sort of left field kind of battle experience.
Good question.
That's a good question. So it's not clear. It's not clear in this. At least the no. She knows. So in the next line, he says, "Because Avshalom ben David, Achos Yafer beShevemes b'Din Torah, Rak Avshalom nolad Achar Shniskara and the Gaira Korul ben David, v'Chen Diak v'Aver Aman ben Tamar." Which means, why is it that the Tanakh goes out of its way to tell us that she is the sister of Avshalom? Because that is her relationship into the family, so to speak, more than it is to him directly, because she was born previously. Meaning to say they share a mother, but they're not actually related to one another in the halachic sense, or related to Amnon in that respect. So therefore, if we think about this, what was that?
He could marry her.
So technically speaking, Amnon could.
Avshalom could marry
her. So Avshalom, technically speaking, yes. There we go. There we go. So apparently that was not the situation that was arrived at. Correct.
So it's not Tamar's.
Correct. Halachically speaking, she.
Correct.
But what our question right now is the Torah has certain limitations on marriage. And those limitations on marriage don't exist in certain cases. And they don't exist in this case. Which means, in Amnon's mindset, when he looks at Tamar, he does think he could marry her. That's what the Malbim is pointing out, based on Chazal. So technically speaking, can he marry her? Yes. So where does the delusion start from? It starts not as a delusion, but as a reality. The problem is the way he goes about it, which I would argue about the Malbim, is that there seems to be a very crooked way of achieving things here. Yeah.
So
couldn't
he just go and ask David?
Good. Good. So precisely. Excellent. So that should be the next logical step. Maybe that's exactly what's happening. So let's move one step further then. So what is the advice? What is the grand advice here of Yonadav, then, in this case? So let's take a look at this. Take a look into source 7. Okay, so Elisha, just to exactly your point. Source 7. He, Rachman al-Nitzal, never wanted to set up at any situation that would jeopardize her or him. Rak sombefiv dvarav shemitocham yakira melech shu chashek betamar achosa v'chole avura al-maves. Why is Yonadav relating to David? Why does David need to be part of this equation? Because the answer is the primary recipient of the conversation is not Tamar, but it is David. David realized that I am desperately and sickly in love with my half sister, and so therefore, so the hope was, Yonadav's grand plan was, is that David should recognize and therefore give her hand in marriage. This is essentially like asking the father of the girl. As I said, that's what Yonadav's great plan was. So that's what seems to be set up according to the Malbim. So over here, there is at least groundwork, there's space for this to exist in some sort of semblance of normality. But Abarbanel says no. Abarbanel says that does not make sense at all. Abarbanel goes to great length in source 4, and he says, "Va'anira elai bozer, hu she'av shalom atamar shneim ayu b'nei David v'shneim yolda oysa ma'acha acharesh nizkaira." He says, there's no indication that ma'acha had this previous history. There's no indication that ma'acha was on the battlefield. They were both her children. They were both her children once she converted to Judaism when marrying as the child of the Melech of Geshur. That's why Amnon calls her my sister. And she, in her voice, calls him her brother. Right? So they clearly are using the right language to sound like there is a halachic relationship. We're going to get there in a moment. So Amnon, betchilas asipur, Amnon Avshalom ben David, achos yafe, lefi she ra'a hakosuv liyachso elov, Why is Avshalom brought into the picture then in the beginning? Why do we need this sort of awkward description of the sister of Avshalom? Because he was the direct sibling, right? So the direct sibling. I would actually add in here as an asterisk to Abba now, and this is going to what's generate a lot of pain for Avshalom. And because it's going to generate pain for Avshalom, maybe the reason why I have the story is because of Avshalom, but not because of Amnon and Tamar. Meaning maybe the reason why this is here is because of Avshalom. We need to have groundwork. Okay, so that's why it's Avshalom. Good. Now, so at this point in time, according to the Abba Arbanel, there is no space for Amnon to ever think that he could possibly ever have a hand in marriage. There's no possibility. And therefore, from the get-go, Amnon is in a place of corruption. Amnon is thinking thoughts, which there is no possibility of consummation. That means to say that it's bad from the start, as opposed to the Malbim, that maybe possibly that he was trying to arrange that David HaMelech should. No, that's not what's happening over here. Which, by the way, also therefore should inform us what the kind of advice his good friend is giving him, right? So Yonadav is clearly aware of the landscape, and Yonadav is giving him that advice, which is why the Malbim says, what is he described as? He's an ish. Chacham Mo'od. He is a wise man. Well, it's interesting. There's no judgment call on wise, are there, right? Right. There are some very wise people who've created some incredible missiles of mass destruction, right? And they're very wise people, right? So wise is not a description of good or bad. It's simply very smart or very intelligent. And that intelligence could be used in either direction, which is why the Tanakh is ambiguous about his wisdom, says the Malbim. Because is this good or bad advice? We don't know. According to the Malbim, it might be well-intended advice. According to Abba Arbanel, it is bad advice. Okay, so now, just a few more pieces over here. Why is he so besotted by her? Like, why is this, what's going on over here? Does Yonadav need to set this up? If we're in the Abba Arbanel's camp, that there's something really wrong over here. So what's the whole deal? Why has he fallen for her so much? And what's Yonadav's real plan? So one answer we see in the Pesukim is that she is yet unmarried. Besolahi, which means that the way the practice in those days is that unmarried girls would not travel about too much. There wasn't a thing, right? Nobody was going out and hanging out in the marketplace in those days, which means he had zero access. He couldn't meet her. So therefore, what was Yonadav's real plan then, according to the Abarbanels in this way of looking at it? What was the plan? Is to arrange a meeting, because he could never meet her. She was Tsanua, she stayed in her house, she wasn't yet married, and he had no access to her, so it was getting her access. According to the Malbim, it wasn't about access. It was just maybe trying to convince David HaMelech that there should be marriage. Yes.
If you go with the Malbim saying that, you know, his explanation, then what does that have to do with the baking and that? It makes no sense. Why would that be part of the plan?
I think what the way the Malbim is understanding it is that he's explaining that he is so in love with her that he is sick. And look how in need I am, you know, of her love. And his description is, let me eat out of her hand, is an intimate description. So he's trying to get David HaMelech to say, let her feed me. David HaMelech, understand where I'm going? Let the marriage, right? So that's what he's trying to convince. And we're going to see if David HaMelech picks up on that hint or not. Okay, so that would be the way the Malbim would look at it. So it's, again, you know, sometimes when we... when we're euphemistic, doesn't he should just got and explain the situation perhaps according to this? Yeah.
I noticed here that I never noticed before that this is not his friend; it's his first cousin.
In which way?
It says
yes, correct.
Nachon. It's his first cousin.
Because it's David Zabela's brother's son, right?
David. So I'm saying, what's the whole story there, meaning
yes, there is more.
There's more
dynamics. Okay,
brother.
Good. Excellent. So I completely agree with you, and we're going to try to unpack the Avshalom part of it as we get further, because okay, there's obviously much more of a dimension going over here than simply a love at first sight experience over here. There's more power machinations, which might be small now, but are going to expand, and I actually want to close with one of those. Okay, just one idea. But let's just first get to the next details. I kind of wish we could just skip over the next section, but we have to we have to go through it. Let's do it just very briefly, and then just one or two thoughts. So what happens? So what happens in the end is tragically Yud Gimel Vav to Yud Dalet. This is our next natural section. Vayishkav Amnon Vayischal. So he gets into bed. He's sick. And so the king comes to see him, naturally, because he is his firstborn, is very dear to him. He's coming to see what's happening with his son. Let her fry for me these two liver voice. It's a discussion. What's the translation in the Mechon Vamre there for that? They have it as liver cake. So pastry. It seems to be deep fried in oil. It is interesting that the word, of course, is related to the word heart. So there seems to be some sort of metaphoric sort of idea here. And he says, and I'll eat from her hand. And make for him the meal. What does David HaMelech leave out? Feeding it from him. So clearly David HaMelech has either ignored or missed that last detail, which was the critical detail, right? So David HaMelech either doesn't feel that there's a threat here, or David HaMelech is pushing him off. He's brushing him off. So she prepares it for him in front of him, and she prepares these pastries. It doesn't eat. So he says, can everybody please leave? Generally not a good sign. Please bring it to my room. She brings the food. She brings it to his room. And she brings it to him. He grabs hold of her. So he demands from her relationship. Please don't rape me. This is not done. Do not do this disgusting thing, this disgraceful action. Where will I take my disgrace? You will be one of the disgraced and disgusting people among Israel. Speak to the king. He will let us marry. Just do this in the right way. And he didn't listen. And he does not listen. That's the terrible parasha. Unfortunately, it gets worse. But let's stop here for just a moment. So there's a lot of things just to think about over here. Is that first of all, David HaMelech seems to miss the message. Now let's think in terms of what's going on over here. She has made a few claims against him, right? So she makes some very specific claims against him, and one of those claims is she says, for my sake and for your sake, right? Don't disgrace me. Don't disgrace yourself. You're going to be a naval, which is like the lowest description of a human being. You know, a naval is just this self-indulgent, you know, animal, so to speak, almost, right? We know naval in Tanakh was of similar nature, the actual person naval. Don't be a naval, and I'm going to have cherpa. That's a very powerful word in Tanakh in general. And then the third thing she says is just speak to the king and let us marry, right? Just speak to the king. So what's going on over here? So if you're the Malbim, for a moment, if this was a possibility, then what she's really saying is, well, yes, technically speaking, we're not related, so marry me. She means it, right? But according to the Barbanel, what do you do here? Right, according to the Barbanel, they're never going to get married. So what's she saying, right? There's no possibility. So the Barbanel takes exactly that into account. Flip back for just a second to the Barbanel, by the second underline. So he says like this, Aval ha'emes yored darakoi, the truth will show the following its way, in the second underline in source 4. Shehayaze bilti efshar kefi adin v'torah, it was not possible for them to ever marry. V'amna ma'ashe omra tamar, daber no el ha'melech, ki lo yim na'eni mimeka. And he said, please, speak to the king, that he, and he will not withhold you me from you. Lo omra ki im lehi natzel miyadoi u'mehatzar she'avo'er. What was she doing? She was taking anything on the table she could. The tanchumim shel hevel hoyu. These were empty words. These were not real words. Hoyu veratasa lidchos abakash. She wanted to just convince him otherwise. Af kibidvorel heira al amosa. Amitas Adavar Ba'omra, Kiloya Sachem Yisrael Alta Ses Navola Azos. And the main frame of her argument was, this is impossible. This is absolutely disgraceful. Meaning to say, because not only is it rape, but it's also rape of a sibling. It's incest and rape, and that's what is going on over here. So either way, there's no easy way out. Amnon has committed a terrible action, and he's going to face the consequences. But nonetheless, this is the way we're at right now. So now, one just last dimension which is worthwhile thinking about over here, and that is let's just sort of for a moment put ourselves into the frame of mind of the Malbim, where the Malbim says that really, Machah, the mother of Tamar, was a Eisha Sifas To'ar, so she was from a foreign nation and got married to David. So it is interesting, if you follow the Torah through, in that section, in Kisaitse, it happens to be that there are three sections at the beginning of Parshas Kisaitse. Parsha number one is what's called Eishes Yafas Toar. A person meets, a soldier meets a woman on the battlefield, and how the Torah constructs the possibility of that relationship existing. The second parsha is what's called Isha Snuan, Isha Ahuva. That a person has two wives. By the way, it's fascinating, just as a footnote. The Torah talks about polygamy. The Torah does not advise polygamy. In fact, it may be argued that the Torah is actually a satirical commentary on polygamy because it never seems to work. Okay, so I mean to say the Torah is talking to an age and stage of humanity, anthropologically, which is still in its pangs of development, which is still moving towards monogamy, where it is not yet understood, but the Torah is slowly advising society to move away from that, because you can see, by the way, in terms of like just the one-to-one, idolatry and adultery are parallels, meaning to say in the Aseres HaDibros, they are the parallels. The second and the seventh are the parallel Aseres HaDibros. And the notion of commitment to one and no one else is also one of the prime basic ideas of the Torah. So there's a movement towards that. So here's an example of where the Torah satirizes it or talks about it. So a person is married to two wives. A man is married to two wives. And he is about to have a child from one of them, but the one who is to have the child first is going to be from the snua, the hated one, which is a strange language to describe. It is only used one other time in the whole Torah, by Leah. Right, it's very fascinating as to what that means. Is it relative? Is it not? What's this emotion that's being described over here? But nonetheless, the Torah tells us as ben asnua yakir lases lo pishnaim. In terms of legalities, the firstborn is still the firstborn. Doesn't make a difference whether or not it was from his love of his life or not the love of his life, wife. And then the third section is what's called Ben Sore O More, which is a wayward and rebellious son, a child who does not listen to his parents and goes to a point, gets to an irreversible point of behavior that requires his being killed, which is remarkable. Whether that ever occurred is a debate in the Gemara. Now, the Rashi tells us, already quoting the Tanchuma, that this isn't simply haphazard three separate parashios. This is a consequential follow-on. Meaning, if there's going to be a marriage in battle, the Torah is saying is what usually happens in those kind of relationships is it's not going to be a good relationship, right? It does not spell for the recipe of great harmonious marriages when one marries a woman from another culture because of looks on the battlefield. Not that was not shared visions or ideals, right? So that it's not going to be a very good marriage. And if it's not going to be a very good marriage, it doesn't mean that it has to be, but it's likely that there's going to be trouble with the kids. And when there's trouble with the kids, right, so there seems to be a consequential flow over here, is what the Tanchuma says. It is interesting to me that in a certain sense, we have an Eishes Yafas Toar in David HaMelech's life. And she has a child. And who is the greatest? And who is the most greatest symbol in all of Tanakh of a wayward and rebellious son is Avshalom, who is the child of that. Isn't that interesting? So the Torah seems to be, what Tanakh seems to be setting up for us over here is the machinations of that inter-sibling rivalry, which is the middle section of those three, is what's happening over here. And it's happening between the two families. And it's a love-hate relationship as well. We're going to see now. At this point in time, the Tanakh uses the word vayeh aver, he loves it. What kind of love is it if it's in about a moment, it's about to turn to? sinner, right, to hate. So we see that there's something wrong, but where was it? It might be in the foundation of the relationship itself, which was the seeds for this, which arrives at perhaps the greatest expression of the Ben Sore Umare. Okay, so this is the starting point. There, it's depressing to stop anywhere in this whole thing. But at the same time, this is a good starting point to be able to follow up with what happens to Tamar and Amnon afterwards. Thank you so much for your time.